This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. This morning we have Malik Temeni on. She's a 16-year-old Palestinian who, upon returning from a visit to her Palestinian West Bank relatives and homeland, entered the race unity award speech in Auckland and won the special award for the speech. And she also won two awards, Tohui Ike Pan Uke, Human Rights Commission Award for Impact, and the Tohu Manakura Te Reo Māori Language Commission Award for Te Reo Māori.
Yeah, kia ora. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really good to have you.
Marvin and I have met a couple of times at multiple different events, and we've had amazing chats, so it's very much my privilege to be on here right now.
Could you talk about why you entered this speech competition and what you learned from writing the speech?
Yeah. So as
I read the speech and listened to the speech, and I was very impressed.
Oh, thank you. So as Marvin said, I entered the Race Unity Speech Awards, and that's the speech awards have been going on for about more than 21 years, where young people from all around the country are going into heats and competing to. It's not really a competition, right? It's speech awards. So it's in the regional heats, it's to kind of see, you know, the top winner from that region. And then the top winners from that go to a national semifinal in Auckland. This was held in May this year. So the regional heats are held in the Race Unity Week. And the regional, the national finals are held in May. There was semifinals with 21 semifinalists, and I was one of them. And then I was privileged enough to have made it to the national final, which is the top six out of the whole country. I believe there was more than 130 people who entered this year. So it's pretty impressive. I'm really proud of myself, and I'm really happy. So the reason I entered the speech competition, I think the reason was I really wanted a place to share my whakaaro about race relations in Aotearoa and also my own experience. I entered the speech competition last year and I didn't make it through. Like, I only made it to the regional one. I didn't make it through to semifinals, which is fine. I think at that point my goal was just to see what it's like so I can do better this year, which hence I did. Last year was quite fun as well. I did a speech about, you know, unconscious bias and how, you know, it's not always – racism isn't always explicit and verbal, but often quiet. And yeah, this year I did a speech about the theme was listening to understand. I'll go into that more in the next question. But I did a speech kind of reflecting on my journey in Palestine, as Marvin introduced me, that I just came back from Palestine recently, and I was able to experience Palestinian culture firsthand again. I've lived in Palestine multiple times in my life, but this time going recently, after the first time that we went after October 7th, was quite hard for my family and I, and it was quite interesting also to see how people's lives kind of have changed after what happened on October 7th. So I kind of entered the speech competition and wanted to share that story. And what I learned from writing my speech is that the power of authenticity, because last year my speech was good, but I don't think it was as authentic as I wanted it to be. I didn't draw as much as I would like to on my personal experience, but this year I did, and I ended up going really far with that speech, winning 2 awards at the national final. So the fact that I was able to write a speech and deliver an authentic speech really made me proud of who I was, and that's definitely the biggest thing I learned from this whole thing, is that the power of authenticity and being yourself can take you a long way.
Okay, could you talk about this year's theme, listening to understand? That's an important question for me, too, because part of my, I guess my religious thought is listening to other people and finding that of worth and divine in every person I listen to.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Marvin. Thank you for sharing. I think listening to understand, I'm going to talk about the first time I ever heard that phrase, and it was... Okay, so other than the speech competition, I am involved in a lot of youth-led organizations, as well as starting my own podcast with one of my friends, Unbox Identities, on ORFM News Zone at 4 p.m. on Wednesday, so that you should listen to. Sorry, I had to plug that, Marvin. But yeah, so in a lot of the spaces that I'm part of, including the campaign to lower the voting age 16 and other things to empower youth voice in Aotearoa, there was a webinar that I was on once, and this guy was talking about the importance of listening to understand and not listening to rebut. And I found that very interesting because it was the first time I've ever heard it, and I was like, I was maybe 15 years old, so it wasn't like, I feel like I should have heard it earlier, the fact that about the significance of listening to understand, how it's something that people are implementing in their lives. And I thought when I saw it on the plane, I was actually on the plane to Palestine when the theme came out for this year's speech competition, and I saw it and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to enter it. Like, I really wanted to, because it was something so – it was a new concept to me still, but it was still quite interesting to talk about and kind of – I really wanted to write about it, because it's like listening to understand is not just listening to rebut or criticize, but it is being there for someone and being fully present when you're speaking to them. Like, such as right now, Marvin, we are having a conversation. We're both like being fully present in this. And that's what listening to understand is, because you're not going in with assumptions. You're not going in with kind of stereotypes already, but you are going in to listen to what the other person's saying. And I think I really struggled with that in Palestine, because I went in and I had a lot of unconscious bias and stereotyping and dehumanization of my own people going in. And I got to a point where I completely forgot like the culture and stuff in terms of like how important it is for people. So I would, I've started making a documentary out of my trip in Palestine, but when I was interviewing people there, I would ask questions like, you know, how was the occupation, whatever. But then slowly I realized that people didn't want to talk about that. They wanted to talk about their culture. They wanted to talk about their food. They wanted to talk about things other than war, because that's stuff that they are living every single day. But they don't always get the chance to share their culture with people who don't necessarily live in Palestine. And I found that very significant. So then I went out to shop owners and asking them about their own shops and the like ceramics. Hebron is my city is really well known for ceramics, for example. So yeah, I think listening to understand was very, very well embedded into my whole journey in Palestine, which is why it felt so close to my heart that I was able to write a speech reflecting on that as well and make it through to that big stage where it was recorded and live streamed for everyone to listen to. And the fact that that type of speech was able to be out there, I felt kind of felt like an accomplishment, because that side of Palestine isn't always shared. You know, I've been telling people that you can go online, search up the word Palestine, and comes up with 100 articles of just like war and rubble and problems. And 100% that is what is going on, you know. But there's also I do believe that two things can exist at once. And there are also people there who love their culture and who want people to listen to them, not just assume. So, yeah, that's why I think the theme, listening to understand, is just so significant.
It sounds like you really learned to listen closely, to be present to other people.
Yeah, 100%. It was very, it was a very pivotal moment. Like, I guess I was always trying to implement listening to understand in my life here in Aotearoa, and I think I definitely do, but definitely not as much as after I went to Palestine. But also in the speech competitions, when I was listening to other people's speeches, I really tried to implement that, because the whole idea of the competition is listening to understand. So even if the people in that room who are delivering the speeches can't listen to one another, then what is the point in the whole thing? Does that make sense? So I was very – it's a conscious thing. As I say in my speeches, listening is not just hearing words. It is choosing to understand people fully. So it's a conscious effort that people have to do to listen to understand people.
Well, if you continue with this, you'll be a great person.
I agree.
Because I think it's really what makes us able to be human, if we're able to listen to other people and understand them. That's what real communication is, I think. I'm not saying I do it all the time, but I think that's the goal of communication, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
So you used your background as a Palestinian in creating the speech. And that's clear from listening to the speech.
Yeah.
You were born in Aotearoa, New Zealand, but you haven't spent all your young life in Aotearoa, have you?
Yeah, so I was born in Dunedin back in 2009. And we've lived very much on and off. Like, we've lived in we came to Dunedin originally in 2008 for my mother. She got a PhD to study her she got a scholarship to study her PhD at the University of Otago in Human Geography. And she came with my siblings, my sister, my dad, and my brother. And then I was born a year later. So I became a Kiwi citizen right away, which was great. And then we spent 5 years here. Once she finished her degree, we went back to Palestine in 2013. And then we lived in Palestine from 2013 until 2018. And then we came back to New Zealand in 2018 until 2022. And then in 2022, we lived in Palestine the whole year. And then we came back to Aotearoa at the end of 2022. And we've lived here ever since, yeah.
Would you have noticed differences in Palestine and the West Bank between your earlier memories and your later visits?
Yeah, 100%. I feel like in my earlier memories of that, it was quite like I think, oh, yeah. So in 2013 to 2018, we lived in multiple places in Palestine. So we lived both in Hebron and in Ramallah, which is another city. And in Hebron, I feel like it was less – so Hebron is the most, like, settler-present area in the West Bank. Like, it's the most occupied in the sense of it's also the biggest city in the West Bank. So I felt the settler presence was quite, like, clear there. But also in Ramallah, I felt like every time we'd go back and forth from Hebron to Ramallah, then we would see, like, Israeli flags on the motorway, and you'd see settlers on your left and right, and it really makes one feel dehumanized, as if their own culture is being stripped away and their own land is being occupied, and you can see it physically. Like, it's not just like a concept at that point. And I feel like when we went back to Palestine last year, the same thing happened. Like, we'd go from Hebron to Bethlehem for a visit, and all I would see around me is like Israeli flags, settlers, and occupation, basically. And it really reminds you that you are occupied, and it's not just like the issue is closer to you than you think. Yeah, and it really, really does hurt. And I think, yeah, moving back and forth definitely affected my identity a lot in terms of giving me a solid, like, identity. Does that make sense? Because I used to think that identity was kind of like a fluent thing that would have to be fixed and you have to know your whole life. But then I've come to the realization that identity is fluid because mine is. And this whole moving back and forth thing really gave me a lot of space to explore my identity and who I am. And I think my Palestinian culture is definitely a big asset to my identity because it shapes who I am in the sense that everything about my life has an aspect of Palestinian culture in it, whether that be the way I walk, the way I dress, the way I talk, the way I think. Everything comes from that root of being Palestinian. And I think that's the thing that I'm most proud of through this whole thing, that I've been able to navigate it and also share my story with other people. Because as I said, I'm involved in a lot of youth advocacy spaces where I can share my identity, but also I've started this podcast with my friend Biddy about identities and young people's identities who are struggling with the same thing that I struggled with for a long time and probably and actually am still struggling with. And also in a lot of things like spoken word and poetry and speeches like this is where I can share how my identity affected me to other people. Sorry, how this back and forth thing has affected my identity to other people. And then hopefully that creates space for them to feel heard, understood, and like they belong.
Hmm. When you talk about Hebron, you remind me of a friend of mine about 20 years ago. I haven't traveled a lot, partly because finances.
Yeah, it's so
but Christina Gibbs was a fellow Quaker, and she had family in England and went back and forth between England. But she went to Hebron as part of a Quaker Christian peace team, and she walked with young students to school because even then they were being harassed by the settlers, especially in Hebron.
Mm.
And she spent about 6 years doing that until she got too old to really keep up with it. And she's probably the one that got me to thinking first about Palestine because of her experiences there. And what you said reminds me of what she experienced, but I think it's gotten worse in the last 20 years. When you moved around quite a bit as a child, and it can be disconcerting to change homes quite often. But you seem to have a very firm foundation. Can you talk about who and what helped give you that foundation?
Yeah, so firstly, I'd want to say I think Christina is also one of my mom's friends. And I think we relate a lot to that story because when we were also in Palestine in December, some other people did they were doing the same thing as her, as like walking people to school in the mornings and stuff. But we can talk about that later. But in terms of the question they asked, it's been very difficult. And I guess my firm foundation has and is still developing. But I think it's definitely developed more than it used to have been, how it was, how my foundation was with identity and like kind of living here. I think who helped me was definitely my mum. My mum, she also obviously moved around with me a lot because she's the one that's moving me. But she's definitely helped a lot in terms of like who I am, what our values are, and always reminding me of that. And also she's been very, very supportive of everything that I do and whatever I want to be as well. And I think that's what is so significant to me, is to have that one person that backs you up, and that is all you need in life, really, because other than that, you don't, like, if you don't, you just need one person to believe yourself and as well as yourself, and then you can do a lot with your life and have whatever foundation you want. So I feel like she definitely helped me. And also, I guess my religion has also helped me ground myself and give me that foundation. Like, I am Muslim and I wear a hijab, and I think all of that kind of joins together to create my intersectional identity and the way that I view the world and the way that I move through the world. And I think it is so significant that I am able to move back and forth but still have that foundation, that grounding in my faith, in my people, in my culture that keeps me steadfast no matter what. And I think my religion is definitely what has helped me, you know that everything will be okay, and everything will eventually turn out to be good, even if it feels so stressful right now. You know, something is going to happen and it'll be okay, and everything's going to be okay. And I think I preach that a lot to people, that, you know, everything will be okay and you are going to be okay no matter how many times you are moving, no matter how many people you are interfering with, whatever. And I think I carried that a lot when I was just in Palestine, like that thing about hope. And even because I went to Palestine and I was at a point in my life where I didn't have much hope about a lot of things, and I was quite burnt out myself. And I think going there so open-mindedly and also carrying that hope and resilience and that foundation really allowed me to see the world in a different way. And then when I came back, I was able to live here way more like grateful after having known my privileges and being able to exercise my rights even more because I'm able to here but not in Palestine. Does that make sense?
Yes, it certainly does.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, that's definitely what it is. My mom, my religion, and also a lot of my family and like friends who I've met, and also just my personality in general. I think I'm quite bubbly and talkative person. I think that has definitely helped me connect with a lot of people in different spaces in order to find that grounding and foundation for me.
I feel when people immigrate, they lose things, but they also gain things.
100%.
I know that my life had been quite different if I hadn't moved to New Zealand when I was reasonably young.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be doing this if I had been stayed in America.
Exactly. And it's a lot of this it's crazy how much like geographical luck can help you in life. And I realized that a lot when I was in Palestine. It's like all of the opportunities that I have in Aotearoa, I only have them because I'm in Aotearoa, because I am living in a quote unquote progressive country that provides these procedures, human rights to people without any limitations. But when I was in Palestine, my cousins would probably dream to do half the things that I'm doing, and that's not because they are less skilled. That is not because they are less of people, but it is simply because of where they live.
Our societies are really shape us in considerably.
Yeah.
And when people talk about poor people being in poverty because they made the wrong mistakes or they're usually defending themselves and their privilege and wealth.
Yeah, 100%. That's the whole thing about classism.
But, you know, for instance, Trump inherited everything he's got. I won't go there.
Yeah.
But you see what I mean.
Yeah, 100%. It's like the power dynamics as well, and that affect people's lives and how they live every day.
Would you like to talk some more about Palestinian culture and life?
Yeah. So as I said and I touched on, my main thing going back to Palestine other than – so we went back because my granddad was quite sick and he's now passed away. But when we went back, my main thing there was to really see people for who they are and not just what the media is making them seem like they are confined to. And I think Palestinian culture, the thing about it is so, so beautiful. And I'm saying that in the most non-biased way as well. So I think my favorite thing about Palestinian culture is definitely the clothing. So we've got a lot. It's called like it's a traditional dress called a tob, and it's basically embroidered embroidery on a long dress, or nowadays you can find it in a short dress or like maybe just a top or maybe even pants. Like it's called tatriz, the embroidery that goes onto goes onto garments, and then the stitches they symbolize Palestinian cities, which is really cool. So there's certain stitches for Hebron, for Bethlehem, for Ramallah, for Jerusalem, Yaffa, Haifa, and all of these different stitches that represent these Palestinian cities. So you could see a dress and you would know, oh, that's from Al-Khalil, Hebron, because it's got this stitch, etc. And I love that so much. And sometimes it's hand embroidered, and sometimes it's machine embroidered. It just depends on people's capacities and stuff. Yeah, and another thing that I love so much is the kefir. So that's become very much more popular since October 7th. The kefir, it's like a solidarity item now, but it's also a cultural item for Palestinian people. It is a scarf, and you can wear it sometimes whether on your shoulders, some people wear it on their heads, some people like to accessorize it. There's a certain like designer brand that makes them into dresses, like kefir dresses, which I think is really cool. But basically the symbols on the kefir, they symbolize different parts of Palestinian culture, such as olive trees. And that's another thing. Olive trees are so important and significant to Palestinians because they are part of our culture and they symbolize so much, especially the olive trees. And this is a quote that I said in my speech, like, growing up on my granddad said, growing up on our land makes us never want to leave. Like the olive trees, we stand as a form of resistance. And that is so true, because Palestinians, we stand still and firm on our land because we love it so much, because it is our land, because it is where our people have stood for centuries and millennia. And like the olive trees, we will stand as a form of resistance. You know, some people are asking why are all Palestinians still in Palestine if this horrible stuff is happening. But it's like, you wouldn't leave your home to go to somewhere else and make a new home if you don't want to. And for us Palestinians, it's our home and our land, and our presence on that land continues to prove that we exist and we have existed for centuries and centuries and centuries. So that's my response to people who would say that. But other than that, I really like Palestinian culture in the terms of we also have dabka, which is like a dance, and I love that so much. And also I just love the hospitality in Palestinian culture. We are very hospitable. I remember when I was in Palestine, the whole month, I think we ate food in our house maybe 3 times, because every single day we would be generously welcomed into someone else's house. And that happens a lot in Palestinian culture and life, is that you are constantly at people's houses, you're visiting them. You know, the Māori concept of manaakitanga is hugely shown in Palestinian culture because we live it every single day, you know, being generous and kind to other people and being hospitable to make sure that everyone else is, you know, feeling comfortable where they are. So yeah, I think that's my favorite things about Palestinian culture and life. Other than the fact that, you know, over there the oppression really does affect people so much, but they still continue with their lives and their work and their school and kind of try and make their lives be as positive as they can, even amidst all of this hardship and occupation.
When you talked about olive trees, it reminded me of how long olive trees live and how they can live, do well in very difficult terrain and climate.
Exactly. I think that's why they're so significant to Palestinian culture. It's because of, you know, they symbolize so much. They symbolize, you know, being strong and standing still and growing up. And then that's also what Palestinians are like. We stand still. We have been there for ages. We have grown up there. And that's why there's so much resemblance, right, because of that steadfastness that both us and the olive trees do have in common.
Is this part of how you Palestinians find resilience as life becomes more oppressive?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think Palestinians, we find resilience through our religion a lot of times. So most Palestinians are Muslim, and if not Muslim, a lot of us are also Christian. And in both of these religions, we find peace and hope and resilience, because we know that, you know, this is our land, this is where our people have been, and we get reassured that, like, you know, one day this will be okay, the oppression will be gone, and one day we will live on our land freely again. And I think the olive trees also do stand as a reason for Palestinians to stay on the land steadfast, because, as I said, it symbolizes so much. It symbolizes who we are, and it just reminds us that even when stuff is hard, we are able to, we are, like, we have it in us. We are able to stay still. We are able to move on with our lives and carry our grief with us, not just leave it back or put it in front of us.
To me, one of the tragedies of the situation is you've got three religions in the same area, and they should have so much in common, and yet they haven't been able to, because of the approach of the Israelis, that hasn't been possible.
Yeah, I think the thing about Abrahamic religions is it's we all do descend from Abraham, and I think it's so interesting how similar we are, yet so different as well. And I think I first noticed that difference, that similarities when I was in Dunedin, actually. One of my Christian friends and I, we were having a conversation and we were talking about religion, and then we realized how similar both of our religions are. And that conversation really stood as a testament to how, you know, we might think that we are so different from each other, but actually we are so similar if we just look at the similarities rather than the differences. Definitely, unfortunately, with occupation, it does make it harder for people to live in harmony despite religions. But, I think it's just a terrible thing that has been put on top of us, which is occupation and the Zionist regime.
Do you think it's possible that the Israelis might sometime realize what they're doing to the, not only the Palestinians, but to themselves?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to point out the difference between, you know, Zionists and Israelis and Jewish people, because technically one of my aunties is Israeli because she holds a Israeli citizenship because she was born in Jerusalem and she doesn't have a Palestinian citizenship. But in terms of the Zionist regime, I think that, yes, one day it is very important. I hope that one day Zionists would open up their eyes and realize how this oppression is not helpful for anyone, really. No one wants to be oppressed. And we have seen it in history so many times that, yeah, this, like, genocide and oppression has gotten nowhere positive for anyone. And it's just this whole thing. It, like, doesn't make peace. It just makes more hurt and resentment and agony in everyone's heart.
How have you found Dunedin since the last 2 years, since the struggle in Gaza has gotten so much worse? How have you found the your fellow Dunedinites over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so in Dunedin, we have been very, very active in this kind of Palestinian activism scene. Like, since October 7th, I remember maybe a couple of weeks after, maybe even that same week, we had a demonstration a protest and rally about, you know, what was going on. And it's been very, like, overwhelmingly good to see how much support there is in New Zealand and Dunedin, out of all places, for a place that's across the world. And it really symbolizes how physical distance means nothing when, you know, the emotional distance is everything. And if we can be emotionally close to Palestinians and show them that we are here and we are doing something for you, then it's that immediately mitigates the argument of what our protest is going to do, you know? And I think it's so significant that we are protesting and showing up because, as I said, it doesn't just show, like, the solidarity, but it also gives the Palestinians here, like my family and other Palestinian whānau, that there are people who care about them and there's people who care about the cause, and the burden of this genocide doesn't just stay on our shoulders, but it is a collective thing that we hold, and it is unfortunate that it's happening. And it doesn't, like, it's not any of our faults, but that's the thing. It's not any of our faults, so why should it be just a problem that some of us carry? And I think that's why it's been so good to have, to see kind of the support from the Dunedin residents for these Palestinian protests and all these events that we hold, because it really does show that other form of solidarity, and it gives us a home away from home. And I really like that. And I think other than like the protests and rallies and marches, we've also been very the Palestinian Fano have been very good at organizing like events to showcase the Palestinian culture and life, such as embroidery nights and how to make za'atar, which is like a Palestinian and Middle Eastern kind of food, and also just other events to showcase the culture over the conflict. And I feel that the Dunedin residents' support on that was also very, very prominent and also very, very helpful. And it's also quite bucket filling. And it makes us feel so happy that people do come to these events and do seek knowledge on Palestinian culture, not just the conflict as well. So, yeah, and my family's involvement has been quite significant as well. So my mum, she does a lot of speeches at the protests. So does my sister and my dad. And we also have a fundraiser called Rosanna for Palestine, which is a fundraiser that my mum runs as well as the support from the family. And we sell cultural items. We sell like chocolates and some Palestinian goods, all to fundraise for Palestinian whānau in Dunedin who may be supporting their family in Palestine. And, yeah, I think that's so significant because it shows that, you know, we are so far away, so we can still make a difference here in Dunedin for the atrocities going back home, and we can still utilize our resources to use them for good, to help people, and to ensure that we are not just sitting in our privilege but also sharing it.
Do you think that we become more human as we build a close, stronger communities, that what we do for each other makes us different humans?
Yeah, I think I was reflecting on – I was actually listening to another podcast, and it was someone talking about the importance of service for them – for their well-being. And I found that very interesting because service doesn't go one way. It goes both ways. So I'm helping you, but then you're also helping me discover my humanity. And I really, really like that because it really does highlight how one person – if you're helping one person, you're not just helping that one person, but you're also helping a whole community. You're also helping yourself discover your own humanity. And I found that a lot in my own, like, things that I do is that I find so much – like, if I'm invited to do a speech somewhere, I find joy in that. But then going to deliver the speech, the feedback that I get afterwards, the people that I've impacted, I find so much more joy in that because that really is the point of it. It's discovering myself whilst helping others discover themselves. And these protests that happen and us standing next to each other, quite literally walking together down streets, it really does highlight how having other people by your side, it makes you more human and it makes you more dependent on other people in a good way.
I felt like in the protest that I got a lot more than I gave.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that's exactly it. It's you are going there not just to stand in solidarity but also learn and also kind of – you are listening to understand when you go there. You are physically going somewhere where you may not be as knowledgeable about or maybe you are but you don't know the people there or something like that. But you are – adding more to your humanity by simply going, let alone when you go and listen and you go talk to people and go to fundraise and donate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the things, of course, was the bad thing was that we had to – it lasted a long time.
Yeah.
But we also were together for 2 years. It wasn't, you know, wasn't a one-off protest.
Exactly. It was like it was building a lot of momentum through those 2 years. And we really did build, like, a strong presence in Otiputi around Palestine and Palestinian people. And I really liked that every time we would have protests, there would be different people there. You know, obviously there's some faces that are always repeating, which is amazing. But it's like there would also be new people to teach about the Palestinian cause and all of that. And I think, definitely 100%. They're so significant.
I think the connections between people build us, but also if we harm people, we first, it's wrong to do harm, but secondly, it actually is bad for the people that are doing the harm as well as the people that are being harmed.
Yeah, it's like that whole thing about you're hurting yourself unintentionally by creating harm for other people. And that's the thing that really sucks about occupation in general and genocide, is that you are intentionally hurting other people, and you're not just killing people, but you're also hurting the fauna of the people that you killed, and then the people who are watching the genocide, etc. And then you see all that, but then it's like you're definitely hurting yourself as well by committing that act, because no normal person would justify that as being okay. You are sick and you are committing so much harm just to yourself as well when you are committing it to other people.
I was friends with at a retreat center for about a year with a young German whose father had been a Nazi and taken part in the Holocaust, and he really felt deeply scarred by this. So, you know, you could see what it's really hard to understand how people do things.
It really is, yeah. And I guess the intergenerational impact of it is quite significant as well, as you're saying, especially for example, victims of it. I was learning at school about Canadians, Indigenous Canadians and Indigenous Americans in the residential schools.
Yes.
And I did a research about the intergenerational impacts on the trauma for Canadian students in the residential schools. And you could really see it in ways such as how they parent their children now, or how they are talking to their children and stuff. You could physically see and measure the tangible consequences that happened after the traumatic experiences that they experienced at the residential schools. I think that's really significant that you pointed that out. It's because, yeah, it doesn't just happen for one person, the victim, but it's also the family that comes after it and the lineage as well.
I think something like the civil rights movement that happened in America, if you participate in it, it changes you.
Definitely.
And somehow we can learn to listen to each other more deeply.
Yeah. We can learn to listen to understand more deeply.
I mean, it's not always easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always simple.
Definitely not. And it's, as I said, like, it's something that you have to be conscious about sometimes, because you can be very lost in it. Yeah.
And you don't ever get so old that you don't make mistakes or you're not. You know, you never get so old that you can't be selfish.
Yeah, it's just we need to start failing forward. We need to start acknowledging our mistakes, but also seeing how we can move forward with it.
Some people believe that you probably learn as much from your mistakes as you do from being right.
I agree. I completely agree, because your mistakes show you what you originally thought was right.
How do you see moving forward, both for yourself and for others?
Yeah, I think for myself moving forward, do you mean as in a professional capacity or as in life? In
general? Both.
Both, okay. So
start with one and finish with the other.
Of course. I think in terms of professional capacity, I'm currently in school, and I want to hopefully go to university next in 2 years. I'm in year 12 right now. And then once I go to university, I really want to be a humanitarian aid worker. Yeah, working with international organizations, with people living in areas that may not be as quote-unquote developed as other countries. That's definitely where my passion lies. As I said, like, that whole thing about storytelling and meaningful representation, also ensuring that people are seen before politics, that's something very big for me. And so, yeah, in terms of that, that's what I want to kind of do in the future as well as, like, after uni. I don't really know what I want to study at uni. I know I don't want to live in Dunedin, but I don't know what I want to study at uni yet. Hopefully I'll figure that one out. And then in terms of, like, in life in general, just continuing with my morals and values, eh? Like, I think it's so significant that I have such a firm foundation, as we've already talked about. But I think it's so important to recognize that I do, and then how do I maintain and sustain that momentum forwards in my life, and how do I ensure that my morals are always at the front line of every situation that I'm going to be in. So I think that's kind of the way that I think I would. In terms of my family, I think it's the same in terms of, you know, always staying steadfast with our morals and beliefs, and also remembering where and why we came here. Where we came from and why we came here. I think it's really significant to look back to go forward, to look back to where I was and to who made me who I am, but also going forward to know who I want to be and to who I want to meet and learn from. So, yeah.
I think it's hard to understand ourselves and know where we want to go unless we know our history.
Yeah, 100%. And it's also like, knowing your history lets you opens you up to so much more that you might be passionate about. For me, I am very passionate about my history and very passionate about learning more about it. Definitely have not learned everything, but it's also a matter of that is how I'm going to be able to understand myself fully. And until I understand myself fully, I don't think I can maximize my potential.
Probably your experience, if you do become an aid worker or a develop worker,
yeah,
your experience will be a great thing to help you listen to people and understand people.
Yeah, I think my experiences really do help me shape, like, what I'm passionate about. Because I've talked to a lot of, like, young people about life in general and about what they want to see out of life. And I think seeing the differences and answers between people here and differences and answers between people, young people in Palestine, there's actually not many different answers. I've asked kids here what they want to see in their future, and they've said, I want to be a surgeon. I've asked people in Palestine, what do you want to do in your future? They also said they want to be a surgeon. They still haven't been opened up to the fact that, you know, these kids, they won't have the opportunity to do that because of where they live geographically, yeah, unfortunately, or at least they won't be able to do it successfully or as successful as they want to be. And I think my passion lies in where I can go and help educate those children and giving them that hope that they can actually become whatever they want to become, and also help them see the beauty in life and still hope and dream big, even though all this horrible stuff is going on around them.
You can help people believe that they can help each other.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I mean, it's good if you can have training and a degree, but you don't have to have that to help other people.
Exactly. And I've actually, that's the thing. I've been thinking of that recently. I've been like, do I need to go to university is the question. Like, I really kind of know what I'm passionate about or where I kind of want to go in the future, or at least I know where I don't want to go
but
in the future.
It'll help you do what you want to do, even if most of your learning is from experience. Those degrees will open doors for you.
I agree. And I think that also with degrees, it comes like the experience and skills, and also the people that you meet. And that can be people that I'm taking along with me on that journey of understanding who I am, what I want to be, who I want to meet, and what I want to do.
And I think if we build community, no matter what happens, whether it's climate change or economic disaster, if you have a good community, if you have the common good in our sights, we can deal with things better.
100%. I think community is so essential, and that's why I like Dunedin so much, because it feels like it is a close, tight-knit community here. And I think there's multiple communities that come into that one small one, and we are all kind of one big family in terms of we're always supporting each other, etc. And it really, like, a thing I like so much about Dunedin, especially like the rallies and the community that we've built in that, is that now I have so many connections with people outside of just my inner circle. And I know a lot of people in like Dunedin who do, for example, music for events or catering, etc. And people have so many passions, and now that gives me more of a sense of community because I know that I have people who are supporting me no matter what I want to do.
It's interesting the amount of the things that people will build community around, like the community music center.
Yeah.
It's people from mostly younger people. You get older people, too, in the community orchestra. And it's part of building community. And the folk club that I'm part of is an intergenerational community. And I think you have that in Dunedin much more than you in some of the bigger cities in the world.
100%. It's like a lot of people who I meet here, I'm like, oh, have you enjoyed Dunedin? And they'd be like, yeah, I love it so much. And I'm like, because I'm not a fan of Dunedin that much. I'd be like, huh, why do you like it so much? And they'd be like, well, where I'm from, there's no tight-knit community like this. They don't do events like this. They don't have community orchestras or bands or whatever. It's just very, very unconnected. And in Dunedin, everyone's connected and everyone has like community initiatives that they work on and stuff that they are passionate about. And I think that's something, as you said, makes Dunedin so significant, is that there is that sense of whānau and community and that sense of belonging for people that can easily be, like, you can easily feel that.
I'm getting old, as probably people may not realize it because you don't see me on the radio. But part of what makes life possible for me is the community that I live around. I live on a cul-de-sac, and we all know each other.
Yeah.
And if we need help, we can get help or we can help other people.
Mm.
And so it's always, I don't think you ever have to stop learning.
Exactly. And I think that's the whole thing about like mutual reliance, right? Like I'm helping you and you're helping me and we are helping each other at the same time. And I think it's so significant that you do have that that community around you and you are able to talk to them when you need something. Because other than that, like what are people for, you know, if it's not for helping each other?
I think it's how we treat each other makes us the kind of humanity we are, for good or ill.
Yes, exactly. Because how you treat other people is how you should treat other people is how you want to be treated. And if you're treating them horribly, then you can't expect anything but horrible back. But if you're treating everyone nicely, then that is what you are most likely to attract back in your life.
Well, I wish you well. And
thank you.
And I'm sure that we'll hear more from you.
Thank you so
much. I look
much,
forward
Robert.
To your graduation from university and someday doing development work in the world.
Yay. Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed this chat so much. And yeah, we'll see you sometime soon.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.